truckers will be honest like white on rice. Duncan laughed. Racist. What? No, it's not. It just means they're about to be up our... I know, just kidding. Duncan didn't wait and began jogging into the woods. Park was close on his heels as the men started the final stretch to going home. Chapter 51. November 15th. Coast of Korea Bay. Sinmi-do, North Korea. Sinmi Island sits off the coast in West Korea Bay. At 20 square miles, the mountainous island is the largest within North Korea's territorial waters. Known for its small fishing villages and steep, jagged peaks, the extraction point was chosen because the island had nearly 100 small inlets and miles of coastal shoreline to choose from. A single road encircled the sparsely populated island. On the western shore, a small peninsula that was completely uninhabited jutted out into the shallow water. The white sandy beaches were ideal for their extraction by the 35-foot-long Naval Special Warfare Rigid Inflatable Boat, or RIB. These high-speed watercraft were capable of reaching 60-mile-an-hour speeds with 4 passengers. The dual Caterpillar inline diesels were turbocharged, making them perfect to encroach into North Korean territorial waters and make a fast retreat without being detected. Exhausted from running the final stretch of beach to the appointed extraction point, Duncan and Park sat in the woods in the event a fishing boat or wayward soul happened by their position. Their bodies began to relax, and their mood was upbeat. 20 minutes to spare, said Duncan, as he checked his watch, for what seemed the millionth time since setting foot in the Hermit Kingdom. Despite the rapidly dropping temperatures and a light mist blowing off the bay, both men were sweating. Park still wore the dead soldier's uniform, which was made of heavy green felt. It helped him retain heat, but the additional sweat was pushing him towards dehydration. Duncan still resembled a North Korean local when observed from a distance. Their clothing choices had served them well as they crossed the final 2 miles over the land bridge connecting the North Korean mainland with the island. Remarkably, during those stressful 20 minutes, as the two men ambled along separate from one another, not a single North Korean patrol came onto or off Sinmi-do. Nor had they detected any patrol boat activity. There were numerous fishing ports along the mainland, and Duncan surmised their pursuers were concentrating on those first. The wind picked up slightly, and the mist turned to a steady drizzle. Both men adjusted their hats and clothing to stay dry. Duncan checked his watch again. It was 15 minutes past the hour. If he was nervous about the delay, that meant Park was about to lose his mind with anticipation. He wasn't as flexible as Duncan was during a mission. He believed in planning, timing, and wasn't much for adapting in the field. Duncan decided to make some small talk. A week ago, we were sitting on the Lucas and you were squalling about being bored. Are you happy now? Did you get your adrenaline fix? Park started laughing. Screw you, cowboy. I guess I would have preferred an operation that blew up a bridge or strong-armed a Russian spy instead. You know, a little appetizer before they threw us into the fray. A warm-up, Bob. That would have been nice. Park shuddered as he wrapped the coat around his body. You're going to be famous, you know. Duncan laughed. Why? Because I'm the one that pulled the trigger? This was a team effort, buddy. There's no way to pull that off without you. Seriously, Duncan, you're going to need to hire an agent and stuff. I see book deals, movie rights, appearances on all the news networks. You'll be just as famous as that guy who killed Bin Laden. Maybe, said Duncan with a shrug. What was his name, anyway? I don't remember, replied Park dryly with a laugh. Me either. Listen, they told us to keep our mouths shut about this op. I seriously doubt the United States government wants to take credit for the assassination of a world leader, even if he is a stooge. My guess is the agency's already starting a disinformation campaign pointing fingers of blame at some poor sap. You know, an up-and-coming general of some kind. Park nodded. Yeah, probably right. We won't even get a medal. Heck, Park, we probably won't get Thanksgiving Day off. The two men sat in silence for a while, as minutes suddenly turned to more than an hour. Occasionally a boat could be heard in the distance, but it wasn't the high-pitched whine the powerful diesels would produce on the RIB.
"I hate not having comms," said Park.
"Me too."
"Listen, you don't think our boys would disavow this mission so much they'd leave us hanging, do you?" asked Duncan.
"I gotta say, a couple things bothered me. First, our buddy James Bond seemed in an awful big hurry to catch a flight the other night. It was as if he handed us the key to a stolen car, patted us on the head, and dashed into the terminal to flee the scene of a crime."
Duncan shook his jacket to repel some of the moisture that had begun to soak it. The coat was not meant for protecting him from the elements, but rather it was merely a useful prop to complete the mission.
"The other thing was the mining town after we left the hide," said Duncan, as he recalled the scene in his mind. "We hadn't been gone 10 minutes, and the place was crawling with soldiers. I suppose I could have underestimated their response time, but I found it strange they'd be deployed to that half-abandoned place."
"That, too," added Park.
"What time is it now?"
"After 11."
Park was getting antsy.
"Dude, 5+ hours late?
They're not coming."
"Come on, man, don't panic. They may be held up by patrol boats."
Park shot back his response.
"Have you heard or seen any patrol boats? Look around, it's pitch black out there. Patrol boats would be shining their lights around the bay, looking for any type of vessel in the water. There would be choppers buzzing the coast. Even if they were dispatched from Pyongyang, they would have joined the hunt."
Duncan didn't have a response, but he was getting the sinking feeling that Park was right. He was beginning to feel expendable. He, too, was puzzled by the lack of pressure being placed on all parts of the Korea Bay coastline. The military could have deployed their million-man army to this region by now. Why haven't they?
"Let's give it till midnight, 0 hour. If they're not here by then, we'll find our own way out of the country. Got any cousins in South Korea?"
"Yeah, actually, quite a few. You get us to South Korea and I'll have us treated like heroes before we head home."
"Deal?"
"Deal."
Chapter 52. November 16th. Sinmi-do, North Korea. It was 0 hour. Temperatures had begun to plummet, and the drizzle had turned to a steady rain. Duncan and Park had moved up the hill to seek any form of shelter from the conditions. A rock outcropping provided them some relief from the moisture, but not the cold, which had now soaked through their clothes into their bodies. The predicted cold front had arrived slightly early. By tomorrow afternoon, the winds and blowing snow would hit North Korea, making travel by water impossible for as long as a week. Both men agreed that avoiding capture, especially under these circumstances, would be impossible for that length of time.
"China's closer," said Duncan, as he and Park weighed their options.
"It's at least 90 miles to the northern limit line from here." The northern limit line was a disputed territorial boundary that separated the Yellow Sea from the Korea Bay. Since it was drawn as part of the 1953 armistice agreement by both North Korea and the United Nations, numerous conflicts had occurred as North Korea refused to acknowledge the demarcation line as agreed upon. Although the U.S. Navy didn't maintain a presence in this part of the Yellow Sea, the South Koreans did. If they could commandeer a boat and make their way into international waters, then hopefully Park could talk their way onto one of their patrol boats, or even a frigate.
"Do you think we'll even get the words U.S. Embassy out of our mouths before the PLA busts us in the chops?" asked Park.
"I don't think so."
"What's your plan?" asked Duncan, as he studied his wrinkled fingertips. His hands were beginning to get numb.
"The closest point of safety is back on the UN freighter," replied Park.
"How are we going to explain that to the captain?" asked Duncan sarcastically.
"Who cares? The captain has an obligation to hoist us up out of the sea. And besides, we'll be on board doing the explaining.
What's he going to do, throw us back overboard?"
"Good point," replied Duncan. He thought about Park's suggestion, and it began to make sense. At this hour, stealing a boat would be easier. Navigating through the small islands that dotted the coastal waters would provide them some cover.
"I wish I'd marked the GPS coordinates of the freighter before we left," I'd just never imagined we would be returning to it.
Park stood and shook off the cold. He was rejuvenated now that they had a plan. He patted Duncan on the shoulder.
Come on, I'm done with North Korea. Let's go find a ride.
We'll sail a heading of due west, which should take us in the direction of where they anchored. Hopefully they're still there.
Duncan stood and readied himself for the trek back to the nearest fishing village.
They should be. The UN crew had a lot to unload, if I remember correctly.
Hey, I feel pretty good, started Park. Why don't we go up and over to save some time? The terrain's nothing like we had to deal with at Kusong.
Sure, I'm up for it. Lead the way, Ranger.
The men began the hike up the 600 feet of elevation until they reached the top. The colder air hit them as a wind gust crossed the more barren landscape. They meandered through the pines and began their descent when they came upon a small road barely wide enough for a jeep. The road was made of gravel, but was a welcome relief for two tired operatives who had struggled to keep their footing on the uneven forest floor. They traveled a few hundred yards down the mountain when their backs were illuminated with flashlights.
"Changzi! Changzi!" yelled a North Korean soldier, ordering Duncan and Park to halt.
Duncan responded by leaping for cover down the side of the road, but Park was a second too late. The gunshot tore through his left shoulder, causing Park to spin around and tumble down the embankment.
"Park!" shouted Duncan as he reached to help his friend.
Automatic fire tore up the pine needles near Park's body, striking him in the foot. Duncan scrambled up the embankment, twice losing his footing in the wet grass soaked by the now steady, freezing rain. He returned fire, which created a thunderous boom of the Barrett's muzzle echoing up and down the trail. The shouting continued, and the soldiers desperately looked to find the source of the return fire. One of the soldiers fired wildly above Duncan's position, but Duncan didn't shoot back. He returned his attention to Park's lifeless body, which lay sideways against a tree stump. He scrambled down the bank and immediately felt for a pulse. His breathing was slow and shallow, but at least he was alive. Duncan frantically looked around to assess his options. He heard the crackle of a radio, and then running footsteps in his direction.
Are there more? If not now, there will be soon.
Park, are you with me? Asked Duncan, as his head swiveled from the road to his unconscious friend.
Crap!
Duncan couldn't hold them off. Even if this patrol of what seemed like two men could be neutralized, the sound of radio chatter reminded Duncan that he couldn't outrun a two-way. He needed to get Park out of there. But to where? The small road wasn't an option. Most likely any additional patrols would come roaring up the hill right towards him. Plus, being in the open left him no cover against the soldiers pushing their way towards their position. He bent down and hoisted Park onto his shoulders. Park's good arm was draped over Duncan's left shoulder, and his right leg was slung over the right shoulder. Duncan quickly contemplated grabbing his rifle, but he simply couldn't juggle Park and the weapon. He'd have to rely upon his sidearm and the magazine stuffed in his back pocket. After kicking the Barrett under a fallen tree and pushing some pine needles to obscure it from view, Duncan, slowly at first, until he got his balance, made his way through the forest as quickly and quietly as possible. The flashlights illuminated parts of the forest, but not in any discernible search pattern. He was working his way down toward the beach when he heard a vehicle sling gravel as its tires spun during an ascent uphill. More voices, more soldiers. Too many to make out a number, but the flashlights told the story. They were running down the hill in his direction. Duncan picked up the pace, now moving at a slow trot, with the weight of Park pushing down on his shoulders. His muscles ached from the cold, damp conditions they'd endured. Now, at 4 in the morning, he was fatigued, cold, and out of energy. Yet he continued his descent. The soldiers were getting closer. They began to fire off rounds in his direction, which were deflected by the pine trees. The number of rounds tearing off the bark began to increase. It was a matter of time. No man left behind. Duncan continued as he began to slip and lose his balance before crashing into a pine tree like a pinball banging against a post. More gunfire. The flashlights became one. Duncan caught his breath and began to run along a sandy creek bed leading toward the sound of running water below. He grimaced. He'd veered off course, away from the beach, and toward a small valley that held a narrow creek. The creek was rising from the cold rain, which had now fully penetrated his body, and added 20 pounds to Parks. Then the final volley came. They'd caught up to him. Despite the darkness, their rounds found their mark. The DPRK Type 88s, their version of the Russian-made AK-74s, ripped through the forest, and 5 powerful rounds embedded into Park's back. The impact forced Duncan forward, causing him to lose his grip on his now dead friend and tumble head over heels, over and over down the creek, until he reached a 30-foot-tall cliff. Unable to gain his footing, he slid toward the edge until he careened over the side. His body contorted in the air as he tried to right himself, to no avail. When he landed flat on his back in the shallow creek, the blow knocked the wind out of him. A barely conscious Duncan Armstrong was floating, face up in the icy waters, toward the tiny village of Jaido. Chapter 53. November 16th. Armstrong Ranch, Borden County, Texas. Intuition had no real scientific explanation. To be sure, scientists tried when they defined the phenomenon as a process that arises within a circumscribed cognitive domain. What? Mothers know the meaning of intuition, even without the guidance of a phrase created by words that don't seem to match. Some called it a gut feeling. Others understood they're tapping into something extraordinary. But they were not sure what. For a mother, intuition was one of the impenetrable mysteries of humanity, a protective mechanism that guided her as she cared for her children. Lucy Armstrong awoke just after 4 o'clock that morning by sitting straight up in bed. Her pillow and nightgown were soaked with sweat, and her body was covered with goosebumps. Major was pleasantly snoring his way until dawn, but Lucy bolted out of bed and immediately ran to the bathroom to look at herself in the mirror. She began to cry. Gentle tears streamed down her face at first, and she forced a laugh to calm herself down. She ran water in the sink to mask the sound from her sleeping husband. But when she looked in the mirror again, the waterworks came in earnest. "Lucy Armstrong, what in the world is wrong with you?" she whispered to herself as she patted her face dry with a hand towel. She reached for a Kleenex and blew her nose, a hearty effort that caused her to chuckle and blow again. After regaining her composure, she checked herself in the mirror one more time and smiled back at her aging face. "Silly girl," she thought, as she turned to return to bed. Rather than going back to sleep, she reached for her iPad to go through her morning routine. Fully awake, and with her normal 5 a.m. inner alarm clock ticking closer, she started with emails and text messages. This time it wasn't just a cursory glance at anything that might have come to her overnight. No, she went directly to the email account designated for contact with Duncan when he was abroad. He'd warned her not to use her personal email account when communicating with him, in case he became compromised. She never asked what that entailed, precisely. But the concept of operational security had been explained to her many times by Duncan and Dallas. Maintaining separation from family, especially when there was a possibility of them being captured, was for their safety as well as hers. She opened the account, searching for a message from Duncan. Nothing. There were no messages via iPad messages, the green one, she called it, in order to differentiate from the blue Facebook Messenger icon. As the so-called IT guru of the Armstrong household, at least when it came to their iPads, Lucy was operating at a second-grade level. She bypassed the weather app and went directly to check the news. Has something happened? Lucy couldn't overcome this sense of foreboding and apprehension. She had worried about Duncan in the past, but never like this. International news dealt with the planned ICBM missile launch of North Korea, which had apparently been canceled yesterday. The usual pundits and experts, all of whom had their own political agenda, pontificated on the reasons for the cancellation. In national news, the American Automobile Association, AAA, issued a press release claiming a record number of travelers would hit the road for next week's Thanksgiving holiday. Nearly 60 million travelers were expected to fly or drive to visit family or take a long weekend vacation. This reminded her of the rodeo kids' planned travels to the Calgary Stampede in Canada next week. She knew how important it was for Cooper to compete. But his prior head injury was still cause for a mother's concern. Is that it? Am I worried about Cooper? Lucy rolled her head and neck on her shoulders to release the tension that was still built up inside her. Her crying spell was over and had now been replaced with a determination to find out what caused it. While it was true that she was concerned for Cooper and the prospects of aggravating his concussion, she trusted her son's judgment. He had a lot of years of bull riding ahead of him, if that was the path he chose. Lucy knew he wouldn't risk further injury, or even his life, after what he'd just been through. She moved on to the local news. Just after dawn, NASA was launching its mysterious X-37B space plane from the newly expanded Johnson Space Center south of Houston. At the behest of Defense Secretary Gregg, the Johnson Space Center had added a rocket launch site specifically for the X-37B. The space plane, which was a smaller version of the now-retired space shuttles, was used for experimentation and risk reduction, according to the article. The robotic spacecraft was controlled by the Johnson Space Center, which had announced the mission 2 days ago. The impromptu press conference and the rushed schedule was unprecedented for the X-37B program. Lucy continued reading the article. Mission's purpose unclear, length of time in space unspecified, experimental nature. The article on the KHOU website in Houston showed a graphic of the projected flight path after launch. Because of the early morning hour, clear skies, and the sun rising in the east to illuminate the rocket, the X-37B would be visible to the naked eye from Amarillo to Lubbock. Suddenly, Lucy got excited about the prospect of a rocket flying overhead and decided to wake her husband up early so they could watch together. Her eagerness overcame her sense of dread. Nothing is happening to us right now. It's going to be all right. Chapter 54. November 16th. The Roosevelt Room, the White House, Washington, D.C. President Harmon and Chief of Staff Acton were several minutes late to the special briefing on the canceled missile launch in North Korea. When they arrived, Secretary Gregg was reviewing a CIA report on tensions escalating between India and Pakistan. He intended to bring this up today, although it was most likely unrelated to the North Korean threat. It was, however, a reminder to the president that the threat of a global nuclear war should be taken seriously. President Harmon entered the room, and everyone respectfully stood and greeted her. She seemed to be in a jovial mood as she passed around two boxes of Krispy Kreme donuts purchased for the occasion. You know, once upon a time, all of us had jobs that didn't require this level of stress. Some of us might discuss the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday preparations. Perhaps the guys might debate who the number one college football team was. These donuts are a reminder that we were all ordinary Americans at one time, at least to a certain degree. The weighty decisions made in this room were once made by others on our behalf. However, all of us have agreed to take on this tremendous amount of responsibility. Our duties require more than political posturing or tweaking of economic policies. Sometimes we make life-or-death decisions on behalf of the American people. From health care coverage to sending troops into battle, what comes out of the room has a profound effect on everyday Americans whom we'll never meet. You have no idea, Secretary Gregg thought to himself. President Harmon continued, A week ago, I threw down the gauntlet to Beijing. I let them know our patience had run out, and so had time for the regime in Pyongyang. I demanded they contact Kim Jong-un to cancel the scheduled ICBM test for yesterday, or in the alternative, have him reprogram the trajectory to travel over mainland China into the South China Sea. If our demands weren't met, then diplomacy would end, and all options would be on the table. President Harmon paused to allow the forcefulness of her resolve to sink in. Secretary Gregg managed a smirk as he passed on the offering of donuts. He'd never been ordinary, and of all people, he knew what it meant to send his troops into battle. Unlike others in this room, he'd seen death firsthand. He'd also expressed condolences to the families of the fallen, something this president couldn't find time in her busy schedule to do. He regained his composure and resisted the urge to put the president in her place. Make no mistake, Kim Jong-un, may the devil welcome him with open arms, was the reason the launch was canceled. It was because he'd been canceled. As you know, the missile launch yesterday was in fact halted, said President Harmon. While we've not been in touch with the Chinese embassy as of yet, I will be expressing my thanks to Beijing for their role in forcing the DPRK to stand down with this escalation in their nuclear program. Secretary Gregg continued to thumb through the CIA report on India and Pakistan, choosing to avoid the president's grandiosity. He detected a long pause in her self-congratulations and looked up. Acton had received a text message and was showing it to the president. Well, Madam President, you are probably now learning what stopped the launch, and it wasn't your superior diplomatic skills. Please turn on the television monitors, instructed Acton. Two staff members scrambled for the remotes, and the screens came to life. MSNBC and CNN cable news feeds revealed a special news alert. Each network displayed a similar chyron, the electronically generated caption superimposed at the bottom of the screen on most cable news outlets. They read Kim Jong-un to make rare public appearance and remarks. Secretary Gregg frowned and shook his head. He sat up in his chair as sweat began to form on his forehead. Calm down, Monty. This is probably a pre-recorded ruse, a disinformation campaign to keep their people in line. Everyone in the room was silent as the volume was turned up on the CNN feed. Allison Camerota, formerly with Fox News, had on her serious Diane Sawyer look. In a rare public appearance, North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un will be making live remarks at the annual Mother's Day parade in Pyongyang in just a few minutes. In 2015, the regime declared November 16th to be a national day of remembrance in his mother's honor. A parade and associated festivities are customary for this event. However, live public remarks by Kim Jong-un are unprecedented. Secretary Gregg was now visibly shaken as the state-run media in North Korea began to provide video footage of the parade. The weather conditions in North Korea were obviously deteriorating as the rain appeared to blow sideways. But that didn't dampen the spirits of the cheering, adoring North Koreans who dared not sit this one out. The sweat was now pouring out of his forehead, and he tried nonchalantly to wipe it away. His hands were cold and clammy. Come on, General, get it together. This is going to be a body double. The cameras eventually zoomed in on the staging area where Kim Jong-un emerged, wearing his father's signature fur hat, pulled over his head, handcrafted with ear flaps, which protected Kim's face from the blowing snow as he waved to the crowd. Protected by plastic curtains on either side of the enclosure, he stood in his signature wool coat, buttoned up around his sizable frame. "Who's the man standing to Kim's right?" asked the president. It's hard to be sure because of the feed's grainy, poor quality, but that appears to be his new state security chief, Jung Won-sek, replied the deputy director of the CIA, who was in attendance. He's a relatively young man, remarked the president. Certainly not cut from the same mold of past military leaders for the regime, added the CIA attendee. He is rumored to be a brutal proponent of the totalitarian regime's military policies. His greatest achievement, which probably earned him the top spot and the right to stand next to Dear Leader, was his success in expanding their Lightning Death Squad. This commando unit can rival many nations. As the camera panned the observation tent, Kim Jong-un flashed his signature grin. To Secretary Gregg, it somehow seemed different this time. Much bigger and toothier. It reeked of arrogance. Secretary Gregg had seen the look before, after he'd cheated death himself. Kim began his remarks, and the English interpreter was able to expertly relay the dictator's defiant tone. "Where is his sister, I wonder?" asked the president. "She's almost always by his side. You'd think, for an event like Mother's Day, she'd be in his presence rather than his newest thug." Nobody in the room answered, as the interpreter continued to translate Kim's opening remarks. Reality began to set in for Secretary Gregg. The assassination attempt had failed. Kim's sister had been implicated and was likely under house arrest, or imprisoned, or dead. The team he'd sent in to kill America's biggest nemesis was unsuccessful, which made him feel less guilty about calling off the extraction team. The risk of entering North Korean waters was too great. The two-man team had no outward connections to the United States whatsoever. Hopefully, they weren't taken alive. The translator continued, but Secretary Gregg had lost his focus. The repercussions of failure hadn't necessarily dawned on him. His eyes darted around the room, and they met the president's. She had been studying him. He felt cold, clammy. He imagined that his face was pale, and the sweat wouldn't stop. "Mr. Secretary, are you all right?" asked President Harmon. No. Yes. Yes, of course I'm all right. I didn't take time for breakfast. It must be a blood sugar thing." The President of the United States leaned across the table and pushed a Krispy Kreme box in his direction. "Perhaps you should have a donut. That might make you feel better." "No. It won't." Chapter 55. November 16th. Sinmi-do, North Korea. Duncan floated for an eternity. He didn't know if he was alive or dead. His body was cold, so he assumed he was dead. He knew this time would come. His dad had told him so. "Son, eventually every soldier runs out of bullets. Although his armor wears thin with time, it weighs heavier on his tired body. He simply must rest, remove his helmet, and lay down his head. It is then that his duties are over." In Duncan's semi-conscious state, he replayed the words over and over through his mind. As the cold overtook him, he found himself unable to remember his father's words exactly. He struggled to gain full consciousness, sometimes becoming angry as his memory failed him. Floating, his body limp, he gave up control of his life. This was not his way of living, but he decided it was the way to die. Giving up control to God when it was his time to be taken to heaven. Duncan abandoned his mental struggle to remember his father's words of advice. He looked into his mother's eyes and visualized the sadness on her face when she learned of Dallas being killed in action. He was home on that day when the dark green sedan pulled down the driveway. Duncan didn't have to wait for its arrival before he knew what it meant. The chaplain emerged from the car first, followed by the notifying officer, and then, finally, a medic, who stood respectfully to the side. His mother came running out of the house, wailing in grief, which brought Duncan and his father racing out of the barn. The chaplain did his best to comfort Miss Lucy, but it wasn't until she joined him in prayer did her grief subside. "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul." Duncan could only remember the first sentence. He tuned out the rest as he began to question what kind of God would take his little brother. He'd made the mistake in confiding to Cooper days later that he was questioning his faith. He couldn't have this conversation with his parents, as their emotions were still too raw. The comfort he'd hoped to receive from Cooper didn't happen. Instead, Cooper blistered him with hurtful, stinging words. "What kind of big brother would send Dallas off to war? You knew better. You knew better." Duncan had lived with the guilt of Dallas's death ever since. He had seen battle and death. He'd seen men and women maimed by powerful weapons, later struggling to make a life for themselves. Sometimes they were shunned by friends and family, which made the wounded warriors feel a pain far greater than the loss of a limb. He'd tried to reconcile with his brother, but Cooper couldn't find it in his heart to forgive or forget. Now karma was taking his life as he continued floating for an eternity. "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul." Floating, Then Duncan felt himself being lifted out of the water, the icy cold moisture falling from his body. He could hear the gentle voice of a woman, yet he couldn't discern what she was saying. A man provided words of support, but they made no sense. Duncan relaxed his body and allowed it to be taken higher, ready to meet God. Chapter 56. November 17th, home of Secretary of Defense Montgomery Gregg, Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Secretary Gregg was not a drinker, but tonight might have to be the exception. There would be no celebratory cigars or pats on the back for a job well done. They'd failed, and the repercussions could be more than any of them imagined. He waited in the dimly lit room for Director Carl Braun and Billy Yancey to arrive. "Gentlemen, sit," said Secretary Gregg with a gruff. He was in no mood for small talk on this evening. He was already irritated that Yancey was out of the country when all of this went down. It had been a long 36 hours waiting for this conversation to take place. Yancey attempted to speak first. "Now, Monty, I understand you're upset, as am I, and of course Carl. All of us are disappointed that we didn't take him out, but we all knew the possibility was there." Secretary Gregg raised his hand, directing Yancey to stop. "I thought you had confidence in these men." "We did. They're two of our best operatives. They'd performed admirably in the..." "Failed this time, didn't they?" "Hold on, Monty," interrupted Yancey. "We all knew of the possibilities." Braun added, "Monty, what happens next is only conjecture. If the men were captured, then I'm sure Kim Jong-un will tell the world what the plot was. You know, that Western powers led by the evil United States were planning to assassinate Dear Leader. We've already started a disinformation campaign to point fingers at the South Koreans, or even within his own ranks." The Secretary Gregg shook his head. "Oh, sure. The fellow from Texas was there, too, remember? How do you explain him?" "His cover had him traveling under German documents," replied Braun. "There are no ties to us whatsoever." "Yeah? Is he going to start sprechen Deutsch when they're ripping his fingernails off, or when that doesn't work, they begin to chop them off altogether?" "They're trained," interjected Yancey. "Nobody can be trained to withstand that," yelled Secretary Gregg. "This ain't Hollywood." "Let them learn the truth," Yancey countered. "It'll just be treated as spin that every government will denounce. Besides, what's Kim going to do about it? He's huffed and puffed for years, and he's yet to blow our door down." Secretary Gregg stood and walked to his desk. He picked up a letter opener and rolled it through his fingers. "Here is one such possibility. World War III. Nukes flying all over the place. Fried women and children from Los Angeles to right here where we sit. Here's the problem. The president thinks she's a diplomatic genius. She can already envision her chapter being written in Common Core history books for the rest of eternity." "I don't think," interrupted Braun, before Secretary Gregg shut him down. "I have zero leverage over her when it comes to a first strike option. She thinks she's won. No doubt she's already planning a state dinner to host that fat kid. The whole idea was to dissolve the Kim dynasty or set us up to fight a war in Asia, not here on American soil." Braun continued his attempts to placate Secretary Gregg. "Monty, we've all reviewed and analyzed Kim's words yesterday. Nothing would indicate that he has any intentions of attacking us. The only thing out of sorts was the fact his sister was absent from the festivities and his new goon stood by his side." Secretary Gregg slammed the letter opener down, sticking it into his antique desk. For a moment, the vibration of the brass knife shook like a metronome. "I saw it in his eyes, gentlemen. I know the look and the feeling. He thinks he's invincible. He's dodged the proverbial bullet." Yancey stood and raised his hands to calm Secretary Gregg. "Monty, all is not lost. We can still make this work to our advantage. There are other ways to accomplish..." Secretary Gregg placed both hands on his desk and growled at his accomplices. "Let me explain something to you both. Kim Jong-un now thinks he's invincible. He's Teflon. His sister is probably dead, and the presence of his new state security chief was a very clear message to this old soldier. If we weren't at war before, we are now. Make no mistake, gentlemen, He'll make his move. We won't know from where or how, but we'll certainly know when.
Chapter 57. November 21st. Armstrong Ranch, Borden County, Texas.
The aroma of hot apple pie found its way onto Cooper's nostrils as he came bounding down the stairs. The family planned on having Thanksgiving dinner together before the rodeo kids pulled out for Calgary. As he hit the landing, he glanced through the front windows. The sun was up, revealing a blanket of frost that had formed on the ground overnight. He hoped an approaching weather system wouldn't slow their trip to Canada. Palmer was walking her horses with one of the stable hands. Undoubtedly, she'd have their hooves cleaned and well-fed before they were loaded into the trailer. Major offered up the use of his Ford F-450 pickup for the trip. It had greater towing capability than Cooper's truck, which was necessary to pull the larger horse trailer filled with hay and three-quarter horses. Cooper agreed to be Riley's hazer during the steer wrestling competition. The cowboys were very territorial at Calgary when it came to sharing the local hazers. Riley acknowledged that he'd be at a slight disadvantage with the less experienced Cooper as his hazer, but he said he'd rather lose with his brother than share money with strangers. "Mama, I've got to have a taste of something," said Cooper as he entered the kitchen. He reached his hand out to snap off a piece of the apple pie's crust. It never got closer than 12 inches before Miss Lucy smacked it with a wooden spoon. "Hey, that hurt!" "It should," she said with a laugh. "Consider it a warning shot. If you dig into anything else in my kitchen, the next one will be on the top of your head." "Geez, Louise, Mama, you're awfully ornery this morning." Cooper found his way over to the coffee pot and poured the morning brew into an insulated travel mug. Lucy glanced over at his choice of mug. "Do you want me to brew another pot and fill the thermos for the road?" "Heck yeah, the caffeine will help me drive late into the night," he replied with a grin. Lucy slipped the pie and the cooling rack out of the way and walked over to the sink. She began to rinse her hands off, and then stopped. She dabbed her wet eyes with a towel. "Mama, I'm sorry," said Cooper apologetically. He quickly moved to her side and put his arm around her shoulder. She sniffled again and wiped her eyes dry. "No, honey, I know you're kidding. It's just, I don't know, this time I'm worrying more than usual." "Mom, is it my head?" "You talk to the doctor yourself on the phone. I'm good to go." "No, Coop, it's not that." "Well, it is partly, but I just worry about you three when you have to travel so far from home. It's a long way to Calgary. You're towing that big trailer through the Rockies with a storm coming." Cooper turned his mother toward him and smiled. "We've allowed ourselves plenty of time to get there. This storm is way out in the Pacific. It probably won't hit until Friday anyway. Worst case is we have to stay another day until it clears out. I promise we'll be safe." Lucy nodded and sniffled again. She wiped her tears for the last time that morning and began to laugh at herself. "Coop, I don't know what's wrong with me. I've had a weird feeling for days." "About our trip to Calgary?" "No," she replied, as she patted him on the chest. She went back to readying their dinner. "At first I thought it might have been Duncan, but I'm not sure." She opened the oven door and began to pull out the turkey. Cooper stepped in to help. "Let me, Mama," he said, as he donned the oven mitts. She readily stood to the side. "Have you heard from him? I kind of miss him." Lucy looked at her son after he made this statement and smiled. "No, but that's not that unusual. When he gets an assignment, he goes dark, as he calls it, for weeks at a time." "Is Daddy okay?" Lucy smiled and nodded as she slid two trays of rolls into the oven. "Yes, fit as a fiddle. Your daddy gets anxious about what's going on in the world, and it's not paranoia. He does focus on the news a lot. It seems to me politicians are always at each other's throats, and evil countries are always trying to rattle our cages. It's been that way for as long as I can remember paying attention to the news. Nothing changes in Washington, and World War III hasn't started. I don't see any sense in getting worked up about it." Lucy touched Cooper's cheek and took the oven mitts off his hands. "I've noticed the happier your father is with his life, especially since retirement, the more concerned he's become about catastrophic events that are beyond our control. The way he's explained it to me is he'll be danged if some solar flare or nuclear war or plague is going to bring harm upon this family.
Cooper laughed.
He said the same thing to me in not so many words. I appreciate that, you know. I've always felt like the Armstrong Ranch could take care of its own, no matter what's hurled in our direction. It's kind of the Texas way, you know.
Lucy began removing the fine silver and cloth napkins from a hutch at the end of the spacious kitchen. She retrieved the carving utensils from a drawer and set them on the kitchen island.
We don't admit this to others, but we do agree somewhat with Governor Burnett on these things. For decades, the politicians in Austin have adopted a Texas-first policy. They believe in what's best for Texans.
I agree. Let other states take care of their people. We'll take care of ours.
It's worked so far, said Cooper.
What's worked so far? Asked Major, as he entered the kitchen with another pie in his hands.
Nothing, dear, said Lucy, as she greeted him with a peck on the cheek.
What do we have here?
Preacher baked the kids one of his signature chocolate pecan pies for the road, replied Major.
Then he laughed as he presented it to Cooper. He didn't want them to go hungry.
Cooper laughed and then asked, Speaking of which, Daddy, you reckon we could get a little food and gas money for the road? You know there's a storm coming, and you don't want us to eat the horses if there's a problem, right?
Cooper Armstrong, protested Lucy, as she went looking for her wooden spoon.
Cooper ran around the backside of the kitchen island for protection, where he earned a playful slap to the back of his head from his father.
Son, I ought to hold you down while your mama gives you a proper whooping.
I was just kidding, said Cooper, with a sense of relief as his dad loosened his grip. But y'all know how Riley eats. He'll blow our budget with us on the road for nearly a week.
A still half-asleep Riley entered the fray and wandered toward the coffee maker.
Don't talk about me, Coop. You eat plenty yourself. And then you get gas, which practically runs me and Palmer out of the truck.
Don't you kids stink up my truck, Major demanded, and don't track a bunch of manure into it either.
Palmer could be heard kicking the frost and dirt off her boots as she entered the family room.
Whoa, this house smells better than Cracker Barrel, she exclaimed from the other room.
Don't you insult my cooking, young lady, said Lucy. Come in here and help your brother set the dining table. It's time to eat.
It's not even 8 o'clock, said Riley, who was gradually coming to life after his first cup of coffee.
It was my idea, said Cooper. I want to get us on the road so we can be in Montana by Wednesday. Thanksgiving traffic will be the worst on Wednesday, except near the border where nobody would be going anywhere because it's too far to get there.
Doesn't matter to me. I'm starving, said Riley.
The Armstrong family had gathered at the table and held hands as Major said the blessing.
Our Father in heaven, we thank you for your blessings, for our family, and for our friends here at Armstrong Ranch. We ask that you watch over and protect Duncan as he does his duty in a faraway land. May you please protect him and deliver him home to his family safely. We ask that you consider wrapping your angel's wings around Dallas as he serves you in heaven. God rest his soul. We give thanks for the bountiful food you've provided us on this Thanksgiving and the loving hands that have prepared it. We give thanks for our lives, our freedoms, and our country in these times of turmoil. Today, as we partake of this food, we pray for health and strength to carry on our lives as you would have us. This we ask in the name of Christ and our Heavenly Father. Amen.
Amen. After a brief moment of silence, the table erupted in praise for Miss Lucy's cooking. She'd prepared all of the Armstrong family favorites, turkey and stuffing, mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes, cornbread dressing, gravy, green beans, sliced cranberry, and apple pie. Plates were loaded, serving utensils made contact with serving bowls, requests to pass dishes were exchanged, and the chatter of the Armstrong family filled the dining room. It was a scene that would be repeated in millions of households on Thanksgiving Day, as people celebrated a uniquely American holiday. For some, it was the start of the holiday season, culminating with the celebration of a new year. It was a time to reflect on years past and to make plans for the future. Emotions ran high. Memories, both good and bad, were recalled. But in the Armstrong family, it was about giving thanks for the blessings God had bestowed upon them. Without saying it, this Thanksgiving moment was about strengthening their resolve to support one another as a family,
to focus on protecting the ones they love, to mend and heal old wounds, and to be ready for the dark clouds that might come their way. Families were like the branches of a mighty oak tree. They might grow in different directions, they might bend, but they didn't break. No matter what, the Armstrong family, like the roots of that oak tree, remained as one. Chapter 58. Thanksgiving Day, Armstrong Ranch, Borden County, Texas. Lucy disconnected the call and settled back under the blanket with her husband. The fire was warming the room, and they had a rare day of doing nothing together. The ranch hands were given the day off to spend with their families. Palmer had called to let them know they'd arrived safely after spending an extra night on the road in Great Falls, Montana. Major pledged to avoid finding unnecessary menial tasks to do around the ranch. The Macy's Day Parade had just ended, and Major flipped the channel on their direct TV system to Fox News. Despite the Thanksgiving holiday, the news never stops. Fox had talking heads debating whether the United States should attack North Korea with a preemptive strike. A member of the British Parliament argued against the action, stating U.S. allies would frown upon the escalation of hostilities without exhausting all diplomatic options. He also said European allies might not necessarily get involved on the United States' behalf if Washington initiated a first strike. On the other side of the political spectrum, a former Marine colonel argued a fully nuclear-capable North Korea was a threat to everyone, including London. He urged the president to act now and decisively before North Korea caught us off guard. He felt the U.S. military was strong enough to go it alone if necessary. "They have this same debate every day," said Lucy. "It's a no-win situation for us," added Major. "I can't fault the president. She's had this dumped in her lap, just like all the other presidents before her. I suspect she'll try to find a way to maintain the status quo and pass Kim Jong-un along to the next occupant of the White House." Lucy pointed at the television. "How about that British guy? He said they may not help us if we go to war with North Korea. You don't pick and choose when you stand by your friends, in my opinion. We'd help them if the roles were reversed." Major sighed as he turned the volume down. "It raises an interesting point, which has been a part of our political conversation for years. We began to adopt a nationalistic approach to things, which I'm all for. As a Texan, I really don't know any other way. But would we turn our backs on a friend in need if they asked for help?" "Who do you mean by we?" asked Lucy. "Are you referring to the United States, Texas, or the Armstrong Ranch?" "Well," said Major with a pause, "I guess you could apply the concept to all three. If France attacked Russia and asked for our help, should the president send in our troops, putting them at risk?" "I don't like the French, so I say no," replied Lucy defiantly. "Okay, Miss Lucy, bad example. What about the British?" Lucy again pointed to the television. "Not after what that fellow just said." Major's chin dropped to his chest, and he chuckled. "Miss Lucy, you're messing with me, right?" She laughed and snuggled closer to him under the blanket. "Yes, in a way, I guess I am. I see your point. We've pledged to stand by our allies in Europe, as well as Israel, Japan, and South Korea. If we've got their backs, then they should have ours." "Fair enough," replied Major, as he mindlessly played in her long hair. "Now, if it was a country we don't deal with very much, like Romania, and they attacked Russia, what do you think?" "Not our problem. You're on your own." Major sat up higher on the couch. He was enjoying this back and forth. "Well, let's think about Texas for a minute. You know how Marion feels about the whole Texas strong, Texas free thing, right?"
"Yes, and I agree with her."
"Okay. What if New Mexico didn't stockpile salt to melt the snow on its roads in the mountains? Should Texas share its salt if it meant a lot of Texas roads couldn't get cleared?"
"No," replied Lucy. "They should have planned ahead. You know, like the ant and the grasshopper. The ant spent his time during the summer gathering food for winter when there wouldn't be any. The grasshopper bounced around and played music with his legs all day. When winter arrived and the grasshopper came to the ant begging for food, the ant just shrugged his shoulders in disgust and sent him away."
So the moral for the story is there's a time for work and a time for play, but no matter what, you have to plan for another day. Lucy laughed. Quite poetic, Mr. Armstrong. I'm impressed. Thank you, he grinned, as he reached for his eggnog from the coffee table. All right, last question. Then we'll talk about what we're going to do today. Fire away. Major took a deep breath, because the conversation they were about to have had weighed on his mind for a while. Let's suppose a catastrophe were to hit us, directly impacting the Armstrong Ranch and the surrounding areas. Or Texas, or the whole country for that matter, interjected Lucy, who was also enjoying the talk. Okay, a major collapse event, economic collapse, cyber attack, pandemic, EMP. We've considered and studied them all. Any of the above, and the citizens of this country fall apart in a matter of days, if not hours, added Lucy. Right. We've prepared as best we can to protect our kids and our employees on the ranch. But what happens when a neighbor and his wife, toting three youngins, say they're hungry and need food? What do we do? Lucy pondered for a moment, and then replied, I guess the Bible tells us to share. Blessed is the one who is kind to the needy. Okay, what if the food they ask us for is what we might need to keep our kids alive for another day? Do we give away what we've stored, or do we make sure we take care of our kids first? Lucy came out from under the blanket and lifted her legs onto the couch to sit cross-legged, facing Major. The Book of Timothy says anyone who does not provide for his own household has denied his faith and is worse than the unbeliever. Exactly, said Major. I believe God would have us take care of our own first, before we give away to others who haven't planned ahead. It's the same as the ant and the grasshopper. Major, how in the world do you turn away from those begging eyes and hungry stomachs? Lucy, you just have to. My duty is to you and the kids first, followed by preacher and the ranch hands. Others should have planned ahead like we did. Lucy and Major sat quietly for several minutes as his words sank in. The news began to show scenes from the first NFL football game of the day in Philadelphia. The stands remained half-filled 5 years after the kneeling protests had begun. Lucy broke the silence. I've never thought about it like this before, but you're right. As selfish as it may seem, we have to take care of our own. We've done it for years, and we've sacrificed in order to protect our kids in the event of a collapse of some kind. Major added, You know what? I'm good with that. Me too, said Lucy. She picked up the remote and pushed the guide button. The Cowboys are playing the Eagles. Do you want to watch some football? That would be different. Nah, not really. I've had a problem with this NFL protest thing for years. They should have nipped it in the bud to begin with, but they were afraid they might offend somebody. Well, look at those stands. I hope the owners and that commissioner are happy with their decision. Lucy turned off the television, but Major added one more comment. Besides, I've always believed a man wearing a helmet while defending his country should make more money than a man who wears a helmet while defending a football. Chapter 59 November 25th, Black Friday, the Calgary Stampede, Calgary, Alberta, Canada. The Calgary Stampede was an annual event held in a Canadian city located in the province of Alberta. Just north of Montana, and to the east of the coastal province of British Columbia, Alberta was known for both its mountainous terrain in the north and the desert badlands to the east. Billed as the greatest outdoor show on earth, the Calgary Stampede's 10-day event attracted hundreds of thousands of visitors to the midway carnival-style rides, live country music performances, and, of course, the rodeo events, including bull riding, steer wrestling, and barrel racing. Once held in July, the rodeo was moved to coincide with America's Thanksgiving Week to gain more television coverage on U.S. networks and to be the final rodeo event of the season for qualifiers to earn the right to participate at the Pro Rodeo World Finals in Las Vegas in December. Neither Palmer nor Riley had a chance to qualify for Vegas, but the experience gained at the Calgary Stampede was invaluable. This was, however, critical to Cooper's chances to move on to the big show in 2 weeks.
He had to have a successful 8-second ride, even if he wasn't top in points awarded by the judges, to qualify for the PBR World Finals. Palmer went into the lobby of the Deerfoot Inn and Casino to check into their rooms. One of the aggravations associated with participating in the Calgary Stampede was a lack of hotel rooms.